G'day, welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction episode, the 340th, The Countess Duchess. My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it. Just a bit there, a Percy Faith and theme from A Summer Place. They invented the term easy listening for Percy Faith music. There you go. The story is about Elizabeth Chudleigh, who we left in Europe but on a deadline to get back to England because she's got legal problems, poor old thing. So she's on a deadline and she's in a bit of a rush, but still finds plenty of time to write to people about her health problems. And that journey will be very dangerous and she might die from it. And it'll be muddy, rocky, rough summer roads, which are so much more dangerous than the wintry, frozen roads. And she's all alone without a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, children, and her dearly departed darling Duke. By the way, could you ask George III to intervene? That would be a no on asking George to get involved. Nobody thinks that's a good idea apart from Elizabeth. Okay, letter to Maria Antonia. Could you get your lad, the Elector of Saxony, your mate, the Elector of Bavaria, and your other mate, the Holy Sausage Emperor, to all write to George to help me out here? And don't say it was me asking, please. Yeah, Maria Antonia, like everybody else apart from Elizabeth, doesn't think this is a good idea to get George involved. Now, the deadline is coming up. Elizabeth's got to get to Paris. And to be fair, Elizabeth was right on the roads being pretty crap. And maybe this time she's right about her health. It's hard to tell because when you've got a hypochondriac like Elizabeth, it's hard to tell. But there does seem to be something about a burst abscess, which meant she had to be carried some of the way in a sedan chair. Even so, she will arrive in Paris before her lawyers. And here's the news. George, Earl of Bristol, is dead. Oh, he's dead too. So, if he's dead, then Augustus is now the Earl of Bristol and Elizabeth is the Countess of Bristol, if we agree she's married to Augustus. Congratulations, Elizabeth, because there are some goodies in that for you at the moment. We think you might be the Countess of Bristol. That might get you the goodies. Elizabeth hasn't twigged yet, but it gives her the right to a trial by her peers, which means the nobility. It gives her the right to bail and reduce punishment, of course, if found guilty. Yeah, we can't punish the nobles as much as we punish you or I, my dear listener. One set of rules for the rich thing kicking in just when Elizabeth needs it. Elizabeth will have to go to England or be declared an outlaw. Off she goes, right into a storm, of course. She needs four people to stand bail or she will be in the slammer. Four guys will stand up for her. Off she goes and she'll be well treated. Bail is set at £8,000. £4,000 for her and £1,000 for each of the guarantors, the four guys. Elizabeth is feeling confident, and so we'll get to work on other things like commissioning a nice new yacht. It's very important. The Romans had thought that her existing yacht was very nice, but it was a bit on the small side, so they were bagging her a bit for a small yacht. It can get better. The Court of the Chancery will fight in her favour. Yeah, that stood to reason. The Meadows Bill has failed. Elizabeth is crowing about a complete victory, but she might be being a bit premature here. That was just the civil case, and to explore further, we need to, visit another rabbit hole. We do. Ladies and gentlemen, meet Samuel Foote. Now, Samuel Foote is a one-legged transvestite satirist. There you go. He's also a playwright, actor, and theatre manager. He's a celebrity and permanently broke. He's been sent to Oxford to study the lawyering, but decided he liked the spotlight and the stage more. Oxford booted him out in any case when he went into debtor's prison. In debtor's prison, he got a letter from his mum asking for money because she was also in a debtor's prison. Yeah, there you go. One of his uncles will murder another of his uncles, allowing him to sell the story as told from the nephew's point of view. He is the same age as Elizabeth, and overlapping social circles has seen Samuel attending events like Prince Edward's birthday party at Elizabeth's house. He has observed Elizabeth from close up. So he's going to write a play called A Trip to Calais, starring Lady Kitty Crocodile. Originally Lady Betty Bigamy, but that was a bit too much even for Samuel. But our overweight widow is on the run from the law. She snaps at her maids, accusing them of flirting while being charming to them in front of other people. She encourages bigamy and boasts about her friendship to the Pope. Word gets out about the play and the Lord Chamberlain will refuse a license to put the play on. So it'll be a battle in the newspapers. Samuel will write that the Chamberlain had taken Elizabeth a copy of the play because he, the Chamberlain, failed to see any resemblance at all between Kitty Crocodile and Elizabeth. Will suggest that Elizabeth show everyone which passages she thinks refers to her. Elizabeth isn't that stupid, so that won't be happening. Privately, he'll be asking for £2,000 to make the play go away. That would be a good time to leave the whole thing alone to die a silent death, but no. People can't help themselves, and so Elizabeth will feel the need to defend herself. Somebody calling themselves Venus will write that it is just malice, even though there is nothing in the character like the Duchess. It is the situation that will force the audience to see her grace in the character. Elizabeth will be introduced to the Reverend William Jackson. He's an Irish journalist and what we would call in our times a publicist. He's an early version of the publicist. And the stupidity can continue. Well, why wouldn't it? He's getting paid now. Samuel Foote will write to Elizabeth saying that out of pity to her, he would refrain from putting on the play. And there, Elizabeth has won. Is she satisfied? Not fucking likely. And she'll feel that she's got to respond. She doesn't have to respond, but she will. She wrote that he was a subservient vassal who had insulted her dignity with his pity and insulted her by his attempts at extortion, and that she was quite clothed in my innocence as in a coat of mail. I am proof against a host of foes. Sam will send the whole lot of the correspondence to the press, and won't they be pleased with that? Unlike Elizabeth, Sam writes for a living. He's a professional writer and he's got bugger all to lose. Elizabeth has a rather large fortune to lose. Sam will write publicly, "But why, madam, put on your coat of mail against me? I have no hostile intentions. Folly, not vice, is the game I pursue. In those scenes which you so unaccountably apply to yourself, you must observe that there is not the slightest hint of the little incidents of your life which have excited the curiosity of the grand inquest for the county of Middlesex, that is, the bigamy case. I am happy, madam, however, to hear that your role of innocence is in such perfect repair. I was afraid it might have been a little worse for wearing. May it hold out to keep you warm the next winter." Elizabeth will continue to somehow want to prove that she is right and Sam is wrong, but it's all too late. Her dignity is gone and the cartoonists are on the case now. Elizabeth clad in the chainmail of innocence, fighting a one-legged transvestite Sam. She has gone from grand dame to laughing stock, making it all easier for those who will sit in judgment to find her guilty. And the entire nation is standing to see what will happen next. Oh, good. You and I, my dear listener, can look at this with cool heads. She's won the Chancery case. The play hasn't gone on, so that's a win and a win. Even if it is just a technical win, she's got two from two. Elizabeth will ask that the case, the bigamy case, be moved from the court of the King's Bench to the House of Lords, where the punishments are way more lenient. Elizabeth has a ton of confidence in herself and so will write to the Lords saying how confident she was in their support. The Bishop of Worcester will say he was staggered by her self-assurance. Lord Mansfield, who is a friend to Elizabeth, will have a good go at getting the thing knocked on the head before it starts. It isn't a matter for the Crown, he says. Yeah, dead right. The Ecclesiastical Court has already settled the matter, he says. Even if the Meadows win, the Duke's will won't be overturned, and as Elizabeth is a peeress, there would likely be no punishment for her, so no deterrent for anyone else. She will curtsy to the Lord, and you will bow back and say, what's the point of the whole thing? Perhaps he should have tossed in that the court case would cost, or perhaps he should have tossed in, look, the Americans are a bit bloody revolting, and if we take on a court case, then that's the only business we can discuss until it's done. So while the Americans establish their navy with John Paul Jones, that banger of 10-year-old girls, the House of Lords were arguing about Elizabeth's trial for bigamy. What a waste of time. He's right, Mansfield, waste of time. Elizabeth's household will send in a note saying she is an unwell duchess. It is all a strain. She's ill in a fever. Her bowels were worn almost to death with sorrow and fatigue, which is I think it's a nice way of saying she's got the shits. She will be seized with fainting from the Chapel Royal. Yes, Elizabeth has resumed being attacked by the vapours. But the Lords are proceeding with setting of dates and setting arrangements and so on. Three doctors will say she has to stay in bed and ask that the trial be delayed by 2 months. Elizabeth will now do what everyone has said don't do and write to George. It's all about poor me and they're trying to kill me type stuff. Bad timing. George, like everyone else right now, is just a little bit focused on America and war, and is France going to join in? Her doctors, though, managed to convince the House of Lords that her memory is disordered because of a fit of a paralytic kind, whatever the fuck that is. New date is sent. Lord Mansfield will now see if it can be just a private affair in the House of Lords. But there are way too many who want it public in Westminster Hall. Not only that, but they make the compelling argument, like Lord Littleton, who said, the offence is so atrocious in nature as to affect civil society more than many other crimes which carried at first a blacker complexion. The line of peerage may be affected if such enormous crimes were suffered to go unexplored. Yes, that's a marvellous argument there from a man who'd left his missus to take a barmaid on a European holiday. Elizabeth is horrified that she will now be a public spectacle. The Lords want a bit of sport, something to liven up the day in between cups of tea and iced bobos. That will see another delay. The bigger the venue, the more lead-in time required. Builders are on the job. Certain of the Lords are out for Elizabeth. They want to bring her down, and even Walpole, who's never had a kind word about her, will write about the Lord Chancellor. The Earl's zeal against her was as marvellous to me as to you. I know reasons why he should have done the reverse. That is, he could have asked the opposite and not gone ahead as Mansfield advocated. Tickets, my dear listener, are like currency. Everybody wants a ticket to the trial. Each peer got 7 tickets for each day of the trial. Each day had its own colour ticket to help prevent a forgery. The most important peers had a pass and repass ticket for the entire trial. The most sought-after seats were in the Queen or Prince of Wales's box or the Duke of Newcastle's gallery. That one led through to the House, where the treats are even better than iced bobos. And instead of tea, there's booze. Yum. people are excited about it. It's going to be a big show and hopefully opened by Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. There are two immediate problems for our Lord, though. First, where do we hold Elizabeth? She should be in custody, really. And second, what do we call her? Do we call her Chudley, Harvey, Kingston, or perhaps Countess Bristol? The Honourable, Miss, Mrs. Duchess, Countess? Hang on, if we start calling her Countess Bristol, then we are not regarding her as an innocent until proven guilty type. Bit late for this bullshit anyway, because the tickets have been printed for the trial of Elizabeth calling herself Duchess Dowager of Kingston. That implies we don't believe she is the Dowager Duchess. Oh dear, I think we've got ourselves into a bit of a tangle already. But let's solve the first problem. Where can she be held? She can be held in the Tower. The Meadows family be very pleased with this news, but Elizabeth is again horrified. Well, no, say the Lords, it's a bit over the top for our enlightened times. She can stay at a home in the custody of the Black Rod. All good, because he's actually a friend of hers. Lots of these guys have fond memories of Elizabeth, the Maid of Honour. Now, the Lords haven't had a trial in 11 years. The last one was 1765, Lord Byron, but not the famous Lord Byron. No, this was the famous one's uncle, who'd been at the boozer with his cousin William Chaworth. These two total dickheads got into an argument over who had the most game on their estate. As if you can take a census of your wildlife. Upper class idiots, that's what they are. So of course it came down to a duel, and Byron popped his sword into Chaworth's guts. Chaworth died the next day, and Byron was done on manslaughter. He was lucky there. Rather than the usual penalty of branding on the hand, Byron will pay a small fine and be on your way, laddie. It pays to be a lord, doesn't it? Anyway, off track. The trial hasn't even started, but guys were charging a shilling for a peek inside the hall. Just the hall. You get a shilling. What they will see for that peak is row upon row of crimson bays. It's the Red Hall. We're getting into a carnival atmosphere. We can be entertained by the trial while showing off our own superior morality. Punters are announcing plays for our evening entertainment after the day's events. All masks, and here's a republishing of the Robert Fielding bigamy trial in 1706. In case you've forgotten, he is one of those who married Babs Palmer, or Barbara Villiers, or Duchess of Cleveland, whatever you want to call her. At the same time he was into Babs, he was chasing after heiress Anne de Lau, but they disguised poor widow Mary Wadsworth as the wealthy widow, and stupid Fielding married her. Not to be put off, he married Babs as well, while also banging Babs's granddaughter. God, he was into it, wasn't he? Naughty Fielding. He was guilty, but he got the benefit of clergy to avoid punishment. People also cashing in with pamphlets to give us details on how the trial will proceed, with a list of peers and what order they should arrive in. Meanwhile, Elizabeth is paying her publicist, the Reverend William Jackson, to feed her version of events to the newspapers. The Meadows family are suddenly thinking things through and will offer to settle for £10,000. Elizabeth's lawyers will advise her to refuse. There's way more in it for them if this thing goes to trial. Only one of her lawyers will recommend she settle, even though we would all recommend that to you, Elizabeth. The whole of us here at English History, Fact and Fiction would recommend you settle. But no, hang on. The others have taken that one lawyer out for a nice dinner of venison and Madeira, and he's now saying, go to trial. And that is his honest, unbiased advice. We will need the witnesses. Let's start with the attorney who had bought a nice new register to have the marriage recorded. He is now the Mayor of Winchester, but will suddenly and urgently feel the need to pop over to Europe. Okay, how about Dr. Arthur Collier, the ecclesiastical lawyer who had helped Elizabeth? Oh no, I'm crooks, says Dr. Collier. Can't get out of bed, mate. Sorry. Tickets are now available for people to collect, and a black market has sprung up immediately. £20 a ticket. Countess Castiglione from Milan and the Duke of Württemberg from Stuttgart are crossing Europe to come to watch the trial. This trial is all the newspapers can talk about. even though we're at war in America. But there you go, it's this trial. This is the big deal. And as you would expect, they are divided, some for Elizabeth and some against. A headline that makes sense to me is this one. Why on earth would she want two husbands? One is punishment enough. When we try a peer, everything else has to stop. The House of Commons and the entire legal system all stop. Right now, George Washington is setting up his headquarters in New York City and English rule is facing collapse. Who cares for our poms? It's all about Elizabeth. Europeans are once again looking at Britain and wondering whatever is going on. You mob are at war, but all you're interested in is the private goings-on of some woman. The carpenters are creating raised seating 10 rows deep. The lords will sit in the middle with their wives and sons on the side. No daughters, thank you. Private boxes are built for ambassadors and royalty. The day arrives and we have as many constables and police officers as we can find on duty. The Morning Post complains about the quality of tickets, which, according to the newspaper, are meaner than those generally delivered for a puppet show. The whole is wretchedly engraved and printed upon a narrow slip of paper. In short, it has more the appearance of a wrapper of Hebb's Best Virginia than an admission ticket to the supreme tribunal of this great empire. Sunday, the 14th of April, 1776, and Elizabeth can receive the bread without yeast and a slug of house red in the Chapel Royal St. James's. But hey, the English just won the Battle of Block Island in America. 10 Americans dead and 14 wounded. 15th of April, 1776, and Elizabeth will be snuck into the hall. No struggling through a gaggle of paparazzi for Elizabeth. And she's not on a pat alone. She's got her doctor, apothecary, chaplain, and a few female attendants. Meanwhile, in London, the demand for hairdressing services is through the roof. The coffee house next to the hall is packed very early on. Lady Bathurst, wife of the Chancellor, had rented the coffee house for the whole trial. Yeah, if you want to get in, then you need Lady Bathurst to agree, mate. Great view from there to watch the peers turn up in their full blingy clothing. Lord Bathurst is at his house providing breakfast for the judges and nobles. Cold tongue and wine for breakfast. No wonder they got gout. He will get going in his state coach drawn by 6 black horses. 4 footmen will be on each side of the coach, and just to clear the way, he had another 4 green carriages going first with the family arms all painted on those green carriages. Despite all precautions, one onlooker will find himself bumped under a cart. His head will go neatly in the path of a wheel, and his skull can be crushed. People had started getting to the hall at 3 a.m. 10 a.m. and the hall is pretty packed with perhaps 4,000 humans. Oh, that sounds like hell to me. About 2,500 are women. And when the sun burst through the crowds and shone through the windows, the sparkly jewels all lit up and light bounced around the hair and the feathers. The ladies are all shimmering, but also they're very bored. We want to start.
Why are we waiting? Why are we waiting? Oh, why are we waiting? Oh, why do we wait?
It's not too bad if you're on the ground floor because you can buy coffee through the window. No, but we're definitely bored, so perhaps some Georgian humour. There will be a noise. 2 ladies feel compelled to rush to the end of a gallery to investigate, but there's a gap between the floorboards big enough for, well, 2 ladies to fall through. Under that gap, there was a lady and a gentleman. The lady, that is the one below, her elaborate hair will be smashed to bits. The mock grass, the flowers, the fruits uncasing the wall, and by separation of the several component parts, showing to every beholder the simple and absurd materials which had helped to support the fabric. Now, our lady, that is, the one who fell through the hole, of course, has no underwear. We're not wearing underwear yet. So her bare bum came to rest upon the gentleman's head. As for our other lady, well, she got kind of stuck, so she's suspended from the gallery in mid-air. The slapstick is not finished yet. Two ladies will enter and their hair will get caught up on the guards' bayonets. Two more will manage to get their hair entangled and have to be separated. 10:30 a.m. and in comes Queen Charlotte. Oh, thank goodness, something to look at. And she's got some princes and a bishop or so. 11:15 a.m.
Why are we waiting? Why are we waiting? Oh, why are we waiting? Oh, why do we wait?
Now, 11:15 a.m. and there's some action. It's the parade of the big dicks coming in. I'm not going to list them all. That would be as boring as actually sitting there watching these knobs walk in. It goes least to highest, so the last one in will be George's brother, Henry, Duke of Cumberland. Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. If you hear that in the court, my dear listener, it not only means hear, it means shut the fuck up, because if we hear you talking, then we'll toss you in the slam. In comes the star of the show, Elizabeth. She will make a nice deep curtsy to the Lord High Steward, who will say, "Madam, you may rise." The prisoner was dressed in deep mourning, a black hood on her head, her hair modestly dressed and powdered, a black silk sack with crepe trimmings, black gauze, deep ruffles, and black gloves, but small remains of the beauty of which kings and princes were once so enamoured. Nothing white but her face, and if it had not been for that, she looked exactly like a bale of bombazine. Well, that wasn't very kind. Bombazine is a fabric, black, used for morning clothes in the olden days. Other papers will be kinder, saying she was magnificently dressed and she sat with calmness and dignity of innocence, and all admitted she looked more like a queen surrounded by obedient subjects than a woman over whom was impending a disgraceful judgment. Oh, there's plenty more like that. I read out the charge so the steward can tell us why bigamy is so bad. I'll shorthand it for you, my dear listener, because you don't want to hear all that crap. Destructive to the peace and well-being of society and God. Oh, there you go. Bullshit and bullshit. Come up with better reasons than that, dickheads. Oh, hang on, Elizabeth is about to plea.
Not guilty, my lords.
Of course, the big deal was, what name did they charge her under? Elizabeth Harvey. Oh, now it smacks of a show trial to me. Let me tell you, I object. I don't know if they can hear me, though. But Elizabeth's lawyers are not fucking about. You mob cannot overturn an ecclesiastical court ruling. Evidence does not matter. Overturning ecclesiastical court rulings has never, ever, ever been done. It is unprecedented. Oddly enough, they'll bring up the case of Augustus's uncle, Mad Tom Harvey, to help their case. I don't quite see how it does. It's a weirdo story, as you might expect, given that Tom's a bit mad. He married when he was 46, Anne Coghlan, who'd been living with him. He was also living with Lady Hammer, who had ditched her husband for Mad Tom. He had a kiddie with Lady Hammer as well. So when Lady Hammer died and left some stuff to Mad Tom, things got complicated. Some of that stuff might not have been hers to leave, and I do not want to go down this rabbit hole, but perhaps it was a fair case to raise to point out that the marriage laws aren't very helpful. Yeah, I think that's the point to it all. The marriage laws are crap. Lawyers and lords will get lots of words out of their gobs, and nobody much cares. The reporting was on their demeanour rather than their words. His manner was unpleasing. There was heat and vehemence in his manner that rather fatigues than strikes the hearers. Elizabeth brought out her churchy document, which says this girlie has the right to marry the Duke. There you got it done and dusted, or should be. On and on it drags with their lawyers and lords, thinking they need to say lots and lots of more stuff. And the poor old audience are not riveted at all. They were expecting a spectacle, and they've scored total boredom. Oh, hang on, there's a mention of carnal knowledge at Conduit Street. Oh, no, it's finished. They moved on. At least there were no rules against food and booze in the audience. 6 p.m. and blessed relief when we move for an adjournment. Then we can have dinner with friends, and that'll be mutton chops, lamb pie, lobster and apple puffs with much recapping of the day's events. Mrs. Barrington will be seized with violent hysterics. Oh, it's those vapours, my dear listener, the vapours. And she continued to be indisposed for a considerable time. Next day, and we get the newspapers, and they are on Team Elizabeth. Even Walpole wrote in a favour. The doubly noble prisoner went through her part with unusual admiration. Instead of her usual ostentatious folly and clumsy pretensions to cunning, all her conduct was decent, even seemed natural. Oh, well, not bad, I suppose, really. Like, it's a bit of insulting here and there, isn't it? But it's not bad. He did query her age, and fair enough, she's put herself down for 50 when she was actually 55. But if we would kindly believe she was 50, then that would mean she was underage when she married Augustus. And that should be the deal. Augustus definitely was underage. It should be just tossed out. Elizabeth is playing it all very well. She's presenting herself with quiet dignity. She has got a bunch of aristocrats against her. Just one 50 or 55-year-old widow, take your pick. And really, we all know these men have banged as many chicks as they could. Here they are now trying to hand out a morality lesson. Yeah. The majority of the people are definitely with Elizabeth, the plucky underdog taking on the establishment. Lady Caroline Fitzroy, who tried to get it on with the Duke and marry him, wishes to disagree with me and tell you that Elizabeth was a brazen wretch. Her husband, that is the Lady Caroline Fitzroy's husband, however, will send flowers to Elizabeth, so fuck you, Lady Caroline. But the guests will leave and Mrs. Barrington will get over a fit and it'll be a different Elizabeth after dinner. She will have a night of miserable agitation. The day's events have been a bit much for her. Ah, well, let's bring on day two and the case for the prosecution. Quite a few people, including the Queen, have had enough of this crap and won't be turning up. But there's still lots of people that want to get in, so selling a ticket is not hard at all. And the prosecution is amazed. Prosecutor Dunning will address the court. They want to rely on some previous case, but they have not said once that Elizabeth is innocent. Therefore, they'll say she's guilty. Yeah, I don't know. Lots more words than that, of course, and the report is that Dunning was rather entertaining. Other speakers will try sarcasm and attack the ecclesiastical court. Elizabeth is not holding up well, so it will be an adjournment for 2 days to Friday. Elizabeth goes off from time to time while this is going on to be bled, if you can believe it. It's supposed to calm you down. The mob is on Team Elizabeth, so we'll cheer and wave when she's out and about. She is an anti-heroine with her eccentricity and braveness. The mob can see that there's going to be no fair play in this trial, and that what it wants to do is put the luck of your birth over romantic love. Elizabeth gets it too. She's making financial arrangements to get what she can out of the place. With 2 days off from the trial, the Lords can talk about the American War for a while, with the papers reporting it's all going very badly with us, and there'll be a new tax. Oh, great. Can we get back to the Elizabeth trial, please? It's more interesting than the bloody stupid foreign war. Day three. The witnesses and Elizabeth can hear her life story as told by other people. Hang on, her lawyers can rebut the prosecution first. What have they got? Justitation is the same as nullity. The first wedding was cancelled, and you can't overturn the ecclesiastical court. Too bad. The Lords have already decided that they were way more important than any ecclesiastical court. Oh no, here comes Attorney General Thurlow to thunder about bigamy corrupting the purity of domestic life, loosening the connections that bound together the moral order, and worst of all, could create civil disorder and the magnificent aristocratic bloodlines and inheritance. That will have the Lords all yelling out in support, of course. Silence in the court!
Let this thundering thunderer thunder a bit more about what a total bag this woman is.
Sure, says Attorney General Furlow, no problem, I can thunder some more. Here it is.
She was just after his money. No love involved. But wait, allow me to give you her biography. She came to London and aged 18, married innocent boy Harvey, 17, and kept her quiet so she could keep getting her wages and his family would not object. She had his baby and let it die. Then she retro-created a wedding register when Augustus looked like he would inherit the Earl of Bristol gig. Why ask for a register to be made for a marriage if it hadn't happened?
Oh dear, that one's a bit tricky. He's got a point there.
Then Harvey wanted a divorce, but that woman talked him into the gestation thingy. But did we hear from the very reliable witness Anne Craddock? No, we did not. The Duke married Elizabeth based upon a faulty verdict.
The newspapers won't be that kind to Furlow, they think, and I'd agree that he's not so much looking to prove bigamy, but get the will overturned. The Lords are making their speeches, but we all know that the biggest corruption is that lot. The Lords, yeah. The prosecutor, Dunning, had scored a peerage and a pension for being Solicitor General. Yeah, fair enough, except he was only in the job for 3 bloody months. Town and Country magazine will write a piece about Furlow, called The Amorous Advocate and The Temple Toast. Furlow, who obviously worries about morality himself, has 3 illegitimate daughters with Polly Humphreys, a barmaid at Nando's Coffee House. As well, he has an illegitimate son, thanks to the Dean of Canterbury's daughter. Yeah, he's a turd, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, a turd. But the gist of what he said was right. But to sink the ship, here comes Anne Craddock, and she's a natural actress. Are you being paid for your testimony, is the first question, and that'll be a no. After hearing it for a bit, it will be, are you quite sure you're not being paid? Eventually, the old hag will spill the full beans of being paid by John Fozard, the keeper of the horses, so we can all see it is on behalf of Evelyn Meadows and that she had checked in with Augustus to see if he or Elizabeth would pay more. Her motive is now apparent. Yeah, it's money, and she can piss off, but she's done some damage. Court adjourned. A couple of peers will object, saying wrap the thing up so we can get back to talking endlessly about America. The papers are mixed on the Anne Craddock testimony. It will come out that the papers were extorting the rival groups for good press coverage anyway. Everybody's just in it for the money, my dear listener. It is always about the money.
So it's nice young men from 10cc being very honest with you, letting you know, I just want your money. Day 4, Anne Craddock is back on the stand and they have got a big old constable to stand between her and Elizabeth. Elizabeth had apparently been frowning and motioning at her. It were coming up that she had rejected a cash deal from Elizabeth to piss off up north. Yeah, dear me. More witnesses to testify this or that. In comes Lord Barrington, who will say that, as a man of honour, he can't betray anything he heard in confidence. And Elizabeth will speak. I do release my Lord Barrington from every obligation of honour. I wish and earnestly desire that every witness who may be examined may deliver their opinions at every point justly, whether for me or against me. I came from Rome at the hazard of my life to surrender myself to this court. I bow with submission to every decree and do not even complain that an ecclesiastical sentence has been deemed of no force, although such a sentence has never been controverted during the space of 1,475 years. Oh, well, that was pretty well done, Elizabeth. And the mob are back on team, Elizabeth. At the end, though, his testimony, that is, Lord Barrington, is neither here nor there. The last important witness is on. Oh, no, it's Judith Phillips, the widow of the Reverend Tom Amos. She will be very detailed in her testimony, but sadly for her, not that credible. She is staying at the Turf Coffee House, and that's despite being totally broke. She is allegedly paying for that herself, and definitely not Evelyn Meadows. No, 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 he's not paying for it. Yeah, right. Elizabeth's lawyers will show her a note in her own writing. My Lady Duchess, permit me most humbly to entreat your Grace's kind intercession with my Lord Duke to continue Mr. Phillips as his steward. In return, the remainder of our lives shall be passed in gratitude and duty. Your nobody much is now interested in either her or Anne Craddock as reliable witnesses. It's apparent that the Meadows family have put them up and they're motivated by revenge and money, and they've brought in a series of common smellies paid to testify against Elizabeth. Even so, the evidence is still pretty damning for Elizabeth, so she can have a fit. Fall unconscious and be taken out to be bled, which is the last thing you do for somebody who is unconscious, my dear listener. Do not let the doctor bleed them, although I don't think the doctors do that much anymore. There is some nice stuff in some newspapers, but now I've told you that they're accepting cash for content, you probably don't care so much. I'm sorry to report to you that cash for comment certainly still goes on today. Day 5, V4 verdict. Elizabeth may speak first, and given that she's got 13 sheets of paper, I'm not going to read out the whole lot. Just to start. My words will flow freely from my heart, adorned simply with innocence and truth. My husband is dead, so I look to you, lords, for protection and appeal to your logic. Yeah, no, you see, the protection thing was a good idea, Elizabeth. Asking them to protect you, that was a great idea. But appealing to their stupid brains, yeah, I don't know. What else has she got? I'm being treated as a criminal for a marriage to the Duke that was sanctioned by the King, by the late Dowager Princess of Wales, and by an ecclesiastical court. For 5 years, everyone thought of me as the Duchess. Bigamy law is for those who piss off to Europe and start another family, not someone cleared by a jactation suit. Think of your wives and daughters. If it can happen to me, it can happen to them. And she had just followed the advice of wise men, and there's no crime because crime requires criminal intent. And look, Evelyn Meadows was disinherited because he's a dickhead. The will names me as heir for life, but then the younger Meadows sons and their kiddies will score the lot. I had to come back from Europe or face being an outlaw, and yet my cash was blocked to try and stop me from coming back. Still, I got back because I want to show you I'm innocent. As for that old bag Craddock, well, why did she ever come in to testify? Cash for comment will be your answer. My words flow freely from my heart, adorned simply with innocence and truth. Marvellous speech, nicely emotional, but not too good on points of law, which is what this is supposed to be all about.
I should mention that those 13 pages were interrupted here and there while Elizabeth went off to compose herself from a good boo-hoo-hoo. On with Augustus's lawyer, who will say that he had interviewed Anne Craddock years before for the Jack Dutation suit, and Anne Craddock told him she didn't remember a cracker about the whole thing. And yet her husband, who wasn't anywhere near the wedding of Augustus and Elizabeth, did manage to testify. In comes a Mrs. Mary Pritchard, who claims that Anne Craddock had told her that she, Anne, had heard nothing in the chapel, and yet she was about to make a fortune. More testimony that the Duke certainly thought he was married to Elizabeth, so Elizabeth can faint again, and thank our giddy aunts, that's the end of the trial. The Lords will adjourn to consider their verdict, have a cup of tea, and pass the ice favours, please. 116 will say guilty. Madam, the Lords have considered the charge and evidence against you, and have likewise considered of everything which you have alleged in your defence. And upon the whole matter, their Lordships have found you guilty of the felony whereof you stand indicted. What have you to allege against judgment being pronounced against you? Well, she's going to faint, you dickhead. That's of course she's going to faint. Elizabeth will then ask for the benefit of peerage, that is, dates, put red-hot things on the hand, thanks. The filthy Attorney General will be, oh no, there is no exemption because you are not a peer, missy. Oh, hang on, you just said she's not married to the Duke, it means she's married to Augustus, so therefore she's a countess. What's wrong with you? Letting you walk free would be a ridiculous disgrace to public justice. Mate, you've even called her Elizabeth Harvey. What's wrong with you? The steward will tell her that her own conscience would be her punishment. There you go, that's better. And if you ever commit bigamy again, then that will be the death sentence for you. And that's it. Guilty, no punishment. We can leave that with the public to chat about for a few weeks or until the next big thing consumes them in the papers. But for us, I think the best thing we can say is the law of marriage is just crap. It's rubbish. Even worse is the law for divorce, which is only open to rich old white men. And that's the real crime here, the law.
Yeah, he the coat of swing. It's just about ready to do that thing. I don't want no tears, I don't want no lies. Above all, I don't want no alibis. This judge is hip, and that ain't all. He'll give you time if you're big or small. Fall in line or this coat is neat. Peace, brother.
Uh-oh, here come the judge. Here come the judge. Everybody know that he is the judge.
Now we finish with sanctimonious bloody judges, thank goodness. Having tried to prevent Elizabeth from returning to England, the Meadows family are now trying to prevent her from leaving. Stiff shit, shitheads. Elizabeth was already on her way to Dover, where her yacht lies waiting. 24th of April, and that yacht with Elizabeth on it will glide on into Calais and a salute of cannon to greet her. 16 months later, and Elizabeth will sail into St. Petersburg. She's got some Russian friends, but she wants to see if Catherine the Great will receive her. The Duke's will is being challenged by the Meadows family, but in the meantime, she's getting the rents and spending more than the rents. She had built a new yacht. Think of bloody big yacht for the rich and famous. The dining room alone was 32 feet by 24 feet. Above that was the state room, same size, which could be used for balls, and you'll fit 20 pairs of dancers in that space. Elizabeth had also been buying up artworks for the new yacht and to send in advance to Catherine and a couple of big dicks to smooth the way in. Yeah, she might not be telling some of those big dicks that they're just loners. All ready to go and problems. Elizabeth wants to sail under a Frenchy flag. A British flag is more likely to attract privateers or pirates. Her ex-Royal Navy captain will say, no, I'm not sailing under a bloody Frenchy flag. God. So she'll replace him with a Frenchy captain. The English crew will now say, oh no, we're not sailing with a bloody Frenchy captain. So she'll replace them with a Frenchy crew. Okay. we can now get going on the good ship, the Duchess of Kingston. Suck on that, House of Lords. Smooth sailing, but the Duchess of Kingston, having gotten to Cotlin Island, is too big to sail down that last little bit to St. Petersburg. Elizabeth has to park the yacht and hop onto a Russian warship. Catherine the Great and her lover, Potemkin, were keen as mustard to meet Elizabeth. They are both Anglophiles, and like Elizabeth, they are big into collecting stuff. Elizabeth will be treated extremely well, and for her, it's like coming home. Russia is the home to ostentatious humans. Yeah, she fits right on in. Everybody's on show. And Elizabeth will be addressed as the Duchess of Kingston and treated like royalty. In Bavaria, Maria Antonia's son, the Elector, had refused to recognise Elizabeth as Duchess of Kingston. And Elizabeth didn't want to be the Countess of Bristol, so she talked him into making her the Countess of Wharf. And there you go. A title of her own and not thanks to any man. Nobody can take that one away from her apart from the Elector of Bavaria. Back to Russia and... what? Hurricane? Yeah, hurricane. Yeah, I know, Russia doesn't get hurricanes. Until they do. And they did. And in a contest of hurricane versus yacht, well, yacht will lose. Elizabeth's lovely new yacht is smashed up. Anchors are gone, cables are gone, rigging, masts, longboat, and more, all gone. Obviously, there's way more damage than the yacht. Hundreds of people were dead. They got drowned when the sea levels rose and destroyed buildings and bridges and Catherine the Great's nice garden. Yeah, destroyed. Sad. Back to Elizabeth's yacht, and the crew had managed to get off. The English will all be saying, well, that's what you get for having a Frenchy captain. You dickheads, the Frenchy captain didn't create a fucking cyclone. But it's a useless bit of wood stuck on a sandbank with some very expensive furniture inside. Do not panic anyone. I can let you know that we have the conventions of hospitality, and that means Catherine the Great will do the fixing up of the yacht. The thing will be raised onto the ice, and that will take hundreds of people. Fortunately, the Russians have hundreds and lots of people. They've got people to spare. The furniture and contents will be stored at the Admiralty offices, and Elizabeth is very grateful. What a shame. Elizabeth had been just about to go back to England for more legal battles. Catherine will send a messenger to England to explain that Elizabeth has been held up due to no fault of her own, and it would be terrible if she suffered from lawsuits from her unforeseen detention in Russia. Elizabeth, though, will still get going. November and the seas are rough, so she's going to have to go overland, and rather Elizabeth than me. The problem in England is Augustus, and Elizabeth resents him for this. She thinks he's only doing it to piss off his brother, the bishop. The Meadows are on hold. They're waiting to see how the Augustus legal stuff plays out. Augustus wants a divorce, but he can't do a cracker about it because the ecclesiastical court found that his marriage doesn't exist. So, yeah, that's the ecclesiastical court. So Augustus faces punishment if he says the marriage does exist. Now, just because the House of Lords says it does exist doesn't mean that Augustus can say it does exist. So he wants the ecclesiastical court to overturn their previous ruling. And let's face it, look, he's got a pretty good chance. Elizabeth, of course, wants to travel in style. Her coach then weighs 3 tons and has got 20 horses to pull the thing along. 20 horses will not be enough here and there, so there are delays while the coach is dug out. It all sounds pretty awful. Augustus, meantime, is as pissed off with Elizabeth as she is with him. He just sees delays and his lawyers have the meter running. He's saying it is absolutely not about any money or financial gain, and in this case he might actually be fair dinkum. He gave her money, and when she married the super-rich Duke, he didn't ask to be repaid. But that's where we might leave Elizabeth for the second week running, needing to get back to England. Into some historical fiction, and this week it is a good time to go and have a look at one of my boyhood absolute favourite characters. This is, of course, the Scarlet Pimpernel. They seek him here, they seek him there, the Frenchies seek him everywhere. Is he in heaven or is he in hell, that damned elusive Pimpernel? The Scarlet Pimpernel and his mates are there to save the poor innocent Frenchy nobility from the filthy revolutionaries with their guillotines. The main tools of these guys are disguises and their intelligence. They are way smarter than the Frenchies. It's a ripping yarn. You can find three versions at least on YouTube, full movies. You've got the 1934 version, Leslie Howard and Merle Oberon, and that was my go-to when I was a kiddie. 1950 version with David Niven and Margaret Leighton, and a kind of TV one with Anthony Andrews and, let's see, Jane Seymour. There we go. The idea of the male and female lead actors is that they are a married couple. He is Sir Percy, and everybody thinks Sir Percy and his mates, who are brave guys helping him out in France, everybody thinks that these guys are just useless, they're hopeless, they're dandies, fops, couldn't harm a fly. Certainly not the Scarlet Pimpernel. So that's my recommendation for this week. Get yourself involved with the Scarlet Pimpernel. But for us, it's just a matter of what we're going to go out with, and what that will be is Down in Mexico with the Coasters. 1960-something? I can't remember. Hope to see you next week. Bye. Bye.
Named Joe. He wears a red bandana, plays a blues piano
in a honky tonk down in Mexico.
He wears a purple sash and a black mustache
in a honky tonk down in Mexico.
Well, the first time that I saw him, he was a sitting on a piano stool. I said, and said, man.